Thank you very much. Would like to restart the meeting now. Just would like to make one brief announcement. Some of you might notice that Damon Silvers is no longer in the room. Just so you know, he actually has joined us now by telephone so we could listen in on the remainder of the discussion. So, Damon, I'm glad you're able to call in to listen in. I'm going to turn the floor over. Great. I'm going to turn the floor over to Greg Skates, Deputy Chief Auditor.
Thank you, Tom. At our last meeting in October of the Standing Advisory Group, we discussed Appendix K, one of the PCAOB's quality control standards related to global audit networks. Today we have a panel of representatives from global audit networks to discuss the quality control practices of their global audit networks, including the procedures contained in Appendix K, as well as the quality control practices in the audits of financial statements prepared in accordance with international financial reporting standards. Many global audit networks include domestic member firms that audit U.S. domestic issuers and foreign member firms that audit foreign private issuers. These domestic and foreign member firms can be associated with other member firms in a variety of ways and often use the same firm name as that of the domestic network firm. In addition, some global audit networks have created global offices to consult on IFRS, or International Financial Reporting Standards issues and implementation with their affiliated network firms. And in some cases, these offices perform the Appendix K filing reviews. The purpose of the panel presentation today is to foster a discussion about the quality control practices of global audit networks to help determine what changes might be needed to Appendix K or other PCAOB quality control standards. Now allow me to introduce our panelists for this session this afternoon. Guy Moore is a partner at Deloitte & Touche and serves as their National Director of Audit Assurance, Quality, and Risk. Guy has been with Deloitte for 25 years and prior to his current role has served Deloitte as a Regional Professional Practice Director, a consultation partner in Deloitte's Quality Assurance Group, and the partner in charge of Deloitte & Touche LLP Practice Review Program. Next to Guy is John Basil. John is a partner at Hayes & Company LLP, which is part of the Moore Stephens Hayes LLP and the Moore Stephens International Network. John has been with Hayes & Company for over 20 years and is responsible for many of the firm's practice areas, including both audit and SEC reporting, where he advises clients and the Moore Stephens International Network affiliates on U.S. GAAP reporting and SEC requirements. Next is Paul Herring. Paul is a partner at Grant Thornton International Limited and serves as their Executive Director, Risk and Regulatory Matters. Paul's responsibilities include the development and oversight of global policies and procedures for client acceptance and reacceptance, safeguarding professional independence, and preventing conflicts of interest. Next to Paul is Jack Day. Jack is a partner at Ernst & Young LLP and serves as the Global Director of Capital Markets and is responsible for quality control of assurance services provided to U.S. foreign private issuers. His responsibilities include accounting, auditing, and other professional practice matters. As with our previous panels, we have asked each panelist to present prepared remarks for about 10 minutes. After these prepared remarks, we will spend the remainder of the session in an open dialogue among the SAG members, panelists, the PCAOB, and observers. Now I'd like to turn the floor over to our panelists, starting with Guy Moore. Guy?
Thanks, Greg. It's a pleasure for me to be here today to talk about the global policies, guidance, and procedures of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu. And from now on, I'm going to say DTT so I can get it all out of my mouth and maybe finish this within 10 minutes. I am a partner in Deloitte & Touche LLP, which is the U.S. member firm of DTT. As Greg indicated in his introduction of me, I've been in the public auditing profession for almost 36 years, almost 25 of those as a partner. I spent 26 years directly in client service, auditing service directly, 16 of those as an audit engagement partner, and the most recent 10 years in the Deloitte & Touche National Professional Practice Network, thus landing where I am today. In the late 90s, I was a member of the SEC Practice Section Task Force that developed what is now called Appendix K, thus the connection for me to be here today. In my remarks this afternoon, I intend to give an overview at a high level of the DTT global organization and structure, to discuss at a high level the DTT audit policies and quality control policies, discuss the internal inspection or so-called practice review program for DTT, the DTT approach and process for complying with Appendix K, and the filing review required under Appendix K, and then a few remarks about assistance that's provided by the DTT member firms to each other, and that would include the U.S. firm as well as by DTT itself. Including a short remarks about the IFRS consultations. DTT is an association of member firms in over 140 countries, with all told over 130,000 people. The member firms are independently owned, consistent with local, legal, regulatory, and professional requirements. No firm or firms control or are controlled by any of the other firms within the association. The firms are bound through an agreement in which they do receive the exclusive rights to use the name Deloitte and Touche and Tomatz and variations of that. And they also, in that agreement, agree to comply with common policies, including quality control and audit policies, and with the governance structure. DTT is governed by a board of directors, an executive committee called the executive, and has a global CEO, all of whom I just mentioned are selected from member firms. DTT has common audit policies and guidance that are based on and comply with the international auditing standards and quality control policies that are based on and comply with international quality control standards. All DTT member firms under the agreement are required to follow these policies and not change them or delete them, but member firms do add to them to comply with local requirements, such as here in the U.S. Our firm here in the U.S. has added to the policies in order to comply with both U.S. GAAP as well as PCAOB standards. DTT has a common technology used by the member firms to drive consistent documentation and consistent application of the common audit approach, policies, and guidance. As to U.S. standards, DTT does have a process to recognize those auditors outside the U.S. who, through training and experience, have knowledge of U.S. GAAP and GAAP and relevant SEC and PCAOB rules, regulations, and standards. The policies, the audit policies for DTT and guidance are developed by the Technical Policy and Methodology Group, which is made up of the senior technical partner, audit partners from the largest member firms. And those policies and changes to them are approved by the Global Audit Leadership Team, which is comprised of the senior audit leaders from the 15 or so largest member firms. The common policies, guidance, and technology are designed to provide assurance that audits are performed by member firms in compliance with professional standards, whether on a single location audit or on a multinational audit. DTT has an inspection program for the audit practices of member firms, and that program is administered by the DTT Global Office. And this is an area both here in the U.S. as well as globally where there has been increased emphasis dedicated resources and focus over the last few years. They're essentially administered in two different ways. The larger, more developed member firms perform their inspection internally with oversight by DTT and a partner or partners from other member firms. For the other member firms, the inspection is performed by teams comprised of audit partners and managers from other member firms formed and overseen by the DTT Global Office. These inspections cover compliance with the audit policies and quality control policies, both at the firm level and at the engagement level. Individual engagements are selected and inspected in this process. In response to findings and results of these inspections, member firms are required to prepare action plans, and then there is follow-up to assure adherence to those action plans. Inspection results and action plans are reviewed by the Global Audit Leadership Team that I mentioned earlier, as well as the DTT Board. There are provisions for remedial and disciplinary actions in response to inspection results. And I guess a final word on inspections is they do include a sample of foreign private issuers that file in the U.S. In compliance with the requirements of Appendix K. Back in 1999, when the SEC practice section adopted the membership requirement that became known as Appendix K, the U.S. firm, as required under that membership requirement of the SECPS, sought adoption of the policies and procedures contained in Appendix K by DTT and the member firms, and that adoption did occur. Appendix K essentially has two specific aspects, a so-called filing review and then the internal inspection aspect of it, which I mentioned earlier. The DTT Global Director of Audit designates the filing reviewers to comply with Appendix K in collaboration with the U.S. member firm's SEC Services Department and National Office. The filing reviews are performed generally by partners in the DTT Global Offering Services Group, which includes both U.S. member firm partners as well as partners from other member firms. In addition to the filing review, registration statements to raise money in the U.S. are subjected to an SEC compliance review over and above the Appendix K review by the SEC Services Department in the U.S. firm's national office. The DTT organization, through its member firms, has significant consultation resources available to assist engagement teams on accounting and auditing matters. For example, for consultations on IFRS, we have a small global office in addition to seven centers around the globe, administered by the larger member firms, which provide consultation on IFRS questions. Another example of that assistance is at DTT firms, second partners and other professionals to other member firms to help develop knowledge and skills in their native country standards and assist in delivering quality audit services by the receiving firm. For example, we have numerous U.S. Partners and managers abroad working in other DTT member firms, and likewise there are numerous professionals from other DTT member firms that work here in the U.S. Well, that provides a high-level summary of the DTT organization, our quality control policies and procedures. I'll be happy to answer questions or participate in the discussion later.
Thanks. Thank you, Guy. I just want to thank the SAG for being provided the opportunity to come to speak here before you today and to give the smaller network perspective on how global quality control works in our environment. It's also quite a change of pace from my day-to-day activities, so I thank you again for that. It's nice to to have a change of pace every once in a while. What I'd like to do is I'd like to discuss two of my main discussion topics today are, I guess, brought about by the discussion topics presented in the information provided. The quality control mechanisms in place at the network level and mechanisms in place at the network level to insist in implementation of IFRS. Those would be, I guess, the question or topic points provided for this discussion panel. Before I get into those two things, I'll probably spend most of my brief discussion on the mechanisms in place at the network and at the local level. I'll try to give you an idea or a flavor of how we go about operating and conducting our audits. But before I do that, I guess it's important to have an introduction or a brief introduction to our global, our global network or affiliation. I'm a partner at Moore Stephens Hayes. We're members of the Moore Stephens International affiliation of firms. Moore Stephens International is a global accounting and advisory organization. It's got with its headquarters in London. The network has over 350 independently owned and operated firms in 95 countries, and it incorporates approximately 19,000 people. To give you a sense for the size and structure of the organization. The objective of Moore Stephens International is to provide services of the highest quality. In particular for this group, it certainly goes towards audit services. Member firms share common values, integrity, personal service, quality, and knowledge. But as we discuss these, I guess it's very important to discuss the network versus association dilemma. There's a potential for fundamental misunderstanding of this global audit network. The literature that we have today talks about global audit networks and foreign associated firms, and those terms are referred to in terms that would imply that they are equivalent, and this is really not the case. And the distinction between those two has fundamental implications for the operation and quality assurance programs by the firms, including monitoring and independence. Two of the most significant factors being common quality control procedures and policies in place and common brand name. These factors are certainly at this point not interpreted with any high degree of precision at this point. I don't think it's up to the panel, I guess, to decide where that goes, but there's still some uncertainty in that area. The network definition debate obviously remains unresolved. The network itself has an internal inspection or inspection process. It's organized out of the London office. It's not tailored to meet any of the specific requirements of the SEC or the PCAOB. All affiliated firms in the association, in Moore Stephens International, are expected to provide audit service in accordance with international auditing standards when called upon to do so by other affiliated firms. The process that's in place considers that a firm with a robust professional infrastructure is significantly more likely to deliver consistent quality of professional work. Accordingly, it's the position of Moore Stephens International that the firm-level model for quality control outlined in ISQC 1 is an effective model for use at the network level. It also facilitates the compliance with the revision or with the revisions of ISA 600 concerning the conduct of group audits. The operation of this model also involves gaining an understanding of the scope, frequency, and effectiveness of other review processes applied at the individual member firms. This is an important concept. The aim of this is to minimize duplication of effort without detracting from the effectiveness of this process. What that means is that the overall structure of this is to maximize the use of testing of quality monitoring processes applied at the individual firms, rather than solely by a central function undertaken to review individual audit files. This promotes an effective review process from the firm and the national levels and offers a more prompt response to emerging issues and changing environments. What this means is that the international organization places a reliance on on the other firm's infrastructure and internal controls or quality controls. For example, it's less likely to place a heavy or internal inspection or inspection process on U.S. registered firms. U.S. registered firms, as we know, have a very substantial process. We are monitored as U.S. firms. We're monitored by the PCAOB as a regulatory authority, AICPA, GAO, and state licensing authorities. So there's less likely that a common internal or quality control process would be appropriately applied at the international level. Future developments in this area with respect to Moore Stephens International is that they are now considering the use of U.S. registered PCAOB firms to be more involved in their review of other firms, so that they can, especially with registered firms outside the U.S. Now, how does this work at the local level? The firm level model is more the firm level model that we employ at the local level here in the U.S. is more aligned with ISA 600. The overall responsibility rests with the signing firm. We take the principal auditor approach. What that means is that if the U.S. firm, Moore Stephens Hayes, is the principal auditor, we take the approach that it's our responsibility and our firm's responsibility to make sure that the audits are conducted in accordance with our standards, irrespective of the international standards that's being employed. Appendix K for this purpose is insufficient for this purpose, because it doesn't really provide enough review of the files to get the signing firm comfortable with being the signing firm. Appendix K is limited to reading the document being filed with the SEC, discussing with the audit partner in charge of the engagements, understanding the U.S. auditing and accounting and reporting standards, and independence. There are significant differences between U.S. GAAP and reporting basis which must be discussed. This would work in an environment where there was a common level of control or quality control, but not in the environment that we work with. So Appendix K doesn't necessarily work for our organization. The principal audit approach, which we employ in the U.S., requires the engagement team or the audit engagement team to assume full responsibility for the audit procedures performed, and they are performed under PCAOB standards. The way we do this is we work with our international affiliates, but we take the approach that we are involved from the beginning of the process, from acceptance and continuance of the engagement. Our firm is involved. Our engagement partners and managers, and everyone in the audit team. The overall audit strategy and plan, the understanding of the environment, both at the client level and at the group level, materiality, risk assessments, responding to risk, consolidation issues, they're all monitored and reviewed at the local firm level. So the principal auditor is involved. The principal auditor, being the U.S. firm, is involved in the nature, time, and extent of the procedures being performed, including planning and field work review. The approval of the audit programs is also done at the local level. Engagement teams discussions happen at the local level as well. As an example, I'll be working with, I'm an engagement partner on a foreign private issuer, and what we'll do is I'll be involved from the acceptance of the engagement stage, the planning stage, the review of the files. I'll meet with the engagement team. I'll go to the local office. I'll meet with the client, meet with the audit committee if that's appropriate. And we understand also that, our clients may be much more scalable in terms of size and complexity than some of the other firms out there. So we're able to do this. It works for works for our organization. So that's the approach that we take at the local level. I guess the other discussion point was how the local or the international networks are dealing with the implementation of IFRS. As previously discussed, we don't have the global network approach. But what we are doing, and it creates kind of a dilemma for us, because as foreign private issuers are going to be filing an IFRS, we may not have the abilities to do that here in the U.S. or the U.S. local firms. Our local firms may not have the experience in IFRS, and what we're doing on the horizon is we're working with our foreign affiliates to to develop those skills. But presently, it's not likely that we, as the U.S. firms in our group, have the requisite skills to issue audit opinions on IFRS. It's a process; it's changing, and we're moving with the times. Also, it's a concern too. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I'm not sure from a regulatory standpoint if we can issue, as U.S. firms, can we issue audit reports under IFRS. I'm not sure if that complies or if there's any restriction with our state licensing authorities and such. So I think it's an area that we need to look to, but it's a developing area, and we need to keep moving forward in that area. Once again, I'll be happy to answer any questions as they come up afterwards. Paul?
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. First of all, just by way of introduction, as Greg mentioned, my name is Paul Herring. I'm a partner in the U.S. member firm of Grant Thornton. But unlike Guy and John, I work full-time in our international umbrella organization. Grant Thornton International is an organization similar to the structure that Guy outlined for Deloitte. So we have a series of independently owned and managed firms around the network. We made a clear, there was really no debate within Grant Thornton as to whether or not we were a network under IFAC when those new pronouncements came out. We clearly are. We have over 25,000 professionals operating around the world in over 100 countries and about 500 offices. The umbrella organization is a non-practicing membership organization, and each of the member firms have a membership agreement with that umbrella organization. We have approximately 40 or so member firms around the network that are registered with the PCAOB today, and approximately 8 of those firms currently are principal auditors for foreign private issuers. We have somewhere in excess of 400 U.S. SEC registrant audit clients around the network. So the structure is pretty similar to what Guy outlined. In terms of quality control practices, first of all, I wanted to just touch on audit methodology, policy training and tools. We do have and have had for some time a centrally developed audit methodology which is standardized around the network. There's centrally developed training on that audit methodology and use of the standard audit software. We're currently going through the rollout of a new improved methodology which is intended to improve the integration of risk assessment and looking at internal controls. The methodology has been designed to help ensure that U.S. public company audits are conducted in accordance with PCAOB audit standards. The U.S. firm's technical training and bulletins on U.S. GAAP and GAAP are made available to other member firms around the network. Those points which I just touched on with regard to standard audit methodology and policy and training, from a structural standpoint, are overseen by the practice. So we have a global practice leader for assurance, and those functions report up to that global leader. However, we have separated within our structure responsibility for the quality assurance aspects, both at the global level and then cascading down into the member firm. So, for example, we have a global independence function that reports up to myself. That function includes development of international policy on independence matters, global training provided with respect to those policies, and the use of an automated independence tracking system that we are deploying around the network to assist our personnel, member firms, and our global monitoring group to ensure compliance with the financial interest restriction rules. We We also have international independence checks that are required to be performed with other member firms around the network before not only new audit clients can be accepted, but also before any client can be accepted which has significant international operations, to protect not only the independence but also to guard against conflicts which may otherwise arise. Another area of quality assurance that we have taken a strong position on globally is client acceptance and reacceptance. A few years ago, we introduced a policy globally that required our global group to approve the acceptance and reacceptance of clients, assurance clients, that met certain higher risk criteria. With respect to our inspection program, we also have a global inspection function, which is staffed primarily with personnel drawn from member firms around the network, but is coordinated by a global group. The inspectors visit all firms in the network at least once every 3 years, and for PCAOB registered firms, they're visited at least once every 2 years. The scope of the inspections includes an assessment of compliance with GTI policies, procedures, and professional standards. And where the firm plays a substantial role in an audit of an SEC registrant, the inspection team is staffed with U.S. personnel to conduct inspection procedures that include consideration of compliance with U.S. GAAP, PCAOB, and SEC standards. In addition, there was a comment made earlier this morning about ISQC 1. Grant Thornton International is a member of the IFAC Forum of Firms, and we have declared compliance with the ISQC 1 provisions around the network. And the GTI inspection program includes an assessment of compliance with this standard for each of the firms. We do have a policy of following up, of course, with the results of those inspections. In fact, one of my personal priorities is to focus increasingly on a consistent response to the results of those inspections. I think that there is a judgment call that has to be made when you're looking at the results of inspections to determine whether, if you've got a firm that is not coming up to standards, whether that firm needs assistance in addressing that performance gap through whatever means are appropriate, or in extreme situations, if you've got a firm that you may from time to time conclude is not going to be able to close the gap, at which point expulsion from the network is deemed appropriate. Results of inspections are made available to other member firms to assist them in considering the extent to which they're able to rely on the work of those firms. And we have a project underway currently that I'm leading to explore ways of further increasing the transparency with respect to those inspection reports. We do, of course, have a gatekeeper function within our U.S. member firm, which reviews all SEC filings by Grant Thornton member firms, including non-U.S. member firms, non-member firm opinions. The reviews are performed by designated U.S. partners, supported by managers and partners on secondment in foreign countries where appropriate. We do not have a global markets group that performs these review functions. I'll touch briefly on the IFRS question, because I know that Jack's going to talk more about that. We do have a central IFRS group. It's a small group. That group focuses on a train-the-trainer model of ensuring that there's a consistent understanding of the current pronouncements that are out there, as well as new ones that emerge. They provide updates and communications around the network, and they provide a consultation service on points of interpretation and practical application of the IFRS standards. And then lastly, our U.S. firm is also developing its IFRS capabilities in a number of ways. I look forward to discussing further.
Thank you very much for inviting me to join the discussion. It's a pleasure to see many of you for the first time in a long time. I'm Jackson Day with Ernst & Young. I actually work for our global organization. I'm going to today focus primarily on IFRS. Before we move on, I would say that many of our practice and procedures with regard to quality control mechanisms would be similar to what's been said before, particularly if you consider the comments of Deloitte because of our size. I guess it's easiest maybe to give you a sense of how our IFRS organization starts out by talking a little bit about our global organization. You know, we have around 140 member firms in our network, which we oversee through seven area structures. We have a global professional practice committee that has oversight responsibility for the network with regard to consistent policies and practices. It's made up of representatives from the seven areas, as well as global. Underneath that umbrella would be our global IFRS group and our global capital markets group. Accordingly, our IFRS and filing reviews are managed or oversaw through the same seven areas. To give you a little bit of context about our member firms, they're obliged to adopt policies and procedures of EYG, including things like acceptance and continuance, training, quality risk management, consultation, global methodology. We have a global implementation tool, which we just updated, independence, globally coordinated internal inspections, and multi-location guidance. All those, of course, are consistent with ISQC1 that's been mentioned a few times today. We globally support really two gaps in our firm. We globally support U.S. GAAP through our U.S. member firm with the assistance of the Capital Markets Network along with the PCOB standards. And then we globally support IFRS in the international standards of auditing, principally through our global structure, because for many of our member countries or member firms, IFRS and or ISAs are in effect or substantially the national GAAP and GAS. Each country does own its own GAAP and GAS, as well as regulatory decisions along the way. So, turning to IFRS, at the top we have our IFRS Policy Committee, which is, again, under the oversight of our Global PPD Committee. Similar, it has global and seven area representatives, the seven area representatives. In addition to that, its primary focus is setting the policy and making the firm interpretations. Supporting it at global is our IFRS services group. They provide the underlying infrastructure. They're kind of the doers. They do things like write the policies as directed, work on communications, guide, training activities, et cetera. It includes a global IFRS leader and a global IFRS technical leader, and it's London-based. Our IFRS area desk provide the representatives that make up the policy committee. We are a distributive model at Ernst & Young. We're probably a little more decentralized, I think, than some of our Big Four competitors in that we have a bit of a virtual national office. We have center, and the same for global. We have center with people around in our different areas. Everybody, I think, has some area oversight to some extent, but I think it's safe to say that we might be a little more distributed than some of the others. Our area desk would be principally involved in the execution of our quality control process besides their policy-making activity through the policy committee. They get involved principally with consultations, and, of course, they would work with the local regulators. So if you're working with you know, a domestic registrant here in the United States, and it was under IFRS, you know, you would work here with the area desk here. Now, with regard to QRM, IFRS QRM, we have policies that extend to things including interpretations, trainings, minimum standards of abilities in order to work on the engagement, which include education and an experience requirement, some oversight and approval type of situation. And in addition, it addresses things like consultations and expert reviews, which are in effect an extension of our quality review. And how does this all fit into foreign private issuers? Well, every foreign private issuer is subject to an IFRS area desk if they're using IFRS as their primary financial statements, or if they're as their primary financial statements. The assignments are made with global input from the global IFRS group, and their principal focus is IFRS accounting and disclosure. Contrast that, we have our filing review program, which focuses on the Appendix K requirements, which includes, of course, auditing, accounting, financial reporting, and independence, as Mr. Ray has previously pointed out, and we carry out those sort of activities through our filing review programs. We do make sure that our filing reviewers coordinate with our IFRS area people, or IFRS expert reviews, in order to surface any issues and to draw on each other's expertise in trying to make sure we have the best product out there. Now, one last thing I want to say in closing that is, I think, relevant in a broader sense is that, there are many exchanges in our global world these days, and people go different places. We kind of have this concept that the country of destination kind of owns their GAAP, their reporting, et cetera, and do similar quality control procedures for all the different destinations, and that's something from our perspective that we continue to work on, and we're actively working on at the moment how to best do that to kind of protect our brand worldwide. Most of the international transactions we see go into multiple countries and often have a U.S. tranche these days. So I'll stop there and turn it back over to Greg.
Thank you, Jack. And I want to thank the panelists for providing us with this background for our discussion this afternoon. In order to generate some discussion along these lines, I'd like to first bring up before you the first discussion question. What quality controls will best promote accurate and consistent application of accounting and financial reporting requirements and audits of financial statements of issuers across the network and ensure that those audits are conducted in accordance with the federal securities laws and PCAOB standards? I'd like to now open it up for any comments and questions from the SAG members. Cynthia Richardson.
Actually, I have a quick question for the panelists. If each of you could say where your umbrella, your main organization, is legally incorporated and physically located, and I heard one or two of you say London, but I just, for informational purposes, would like to know that. And then my second question is, how are disagreements among member firms about what are the appropriate quality controls, procedures, processes, policies, how are those disagreements addressed or resolved?
Our the Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu organization is legally a Swiss Verein, but our global office is located in London.
Cynthia, our as I mentioned earlier, our international organization is located in London, and with respect to how we deal with disagreements. As I mentioned earlier, the way we operate may probably a lot differently than the other panelists' firms, in that it's within our firm. It's the quality control procedures employed within our firm. So certainly there are processes for disagreements within the firm, and we follow those. But remember, as we take on the principal auditor approach, so we actually use our affiliates, work with our affiliates to make the work our own. So it's a little bit different in that regard.
Grant Thornton International is incorporated in the United Kingdom, and the physical office, head office, is in London also. In terms of in disagreements, with respect to disagreements on professional standards within an engagement, those policies tend to be determined at the national level within the member firms concerned. We do have policies in place for situations where there are other kinds of disagreements. If there are issues, for example, with respect to sharing of risk and liability across national boundaries, that's a tough issue, one which we do have some principles around. But the engagement disagreements are handled within the policies of the member firms.
Our organization is London-based. With regard to disagreements, we have a consultation chain that works through our global professional practice network. It depends on the nature of the issue at hand, but with regard to PCOB standards and U.S. GAAP, we would look to our U.S. member firm for advice and resolution of the matter.
Joe Carcello.
I have a question for Guy and then a question for Jack. Let me start with a question for Guy. You indicate that the Deloitte network is member firms in over 130 different countries. So the question I would have is, as you do internal inspections across those different firms, presumably you don't have exactly the same quality in each of 130 countries. That would be statistically impossible. So to the extent that you have differences in quality, a couple of questions. One is, do you then ratchet up either the frequency or the rigor of internal inspection processes in, let's say, year two and year three to make sure that level of performance improves? And the second question related to Guy is, you talk about the member firms agree to comply with common policies, common technology, so forth. What about common rules on evaluation and pay for people? Because unless the performance is very bad, presumably you're not going to kick a firm out of the network. It would probably have to be very bad for you to do that. So how do you discipline the individual partner if you don't have common standards for performance evaluation and pay? For Jack, the question I would ask you is, you talked a lot about IFRS. Has your firm basically, one of the things we talked about at our last meeting was the potential risk of IFRS allowing more earnings management. So a question I would ask is, if you took all of the companies that reported on the, let's say, U.S. GAAP, to the extent you have enough observations to do this beforehand, and then move to IFRS, have you seen a change in the mean and the variance of reported earnings numbers?
Okay, I'll go first. With respect to inspection results, I dare say that you're right. I don't know about statistically, but you are correct that there is varying quality, as illustrated by inspection results from firm to firm within the DTT network. As I mentioned earlier in my remarks, the results result in an action plan being developed as a result of the findings of an inspection of a firm, and those result that those action steps could go could range all the way from what I call more remedial, like training and so forth for the individuals involved, all the way to recommendations that the that individuals not continue to work on audits until they've completed enough remedial actions to again be allowed to do so. In terms of does that translate into frequency, an increase in frequency? I suppose it could, depending upon the severity of the findings or the belief that the action plans that have been agreed to and put in place are not being followed. I was going to get to that. As far as common, as far as evaluation, partner evaluation, and compensation, I'm really not qualified to to respond to that. Although I believe that's left up to the individual member firms. Having said that, as it relates to performance that would affect audit work on, for example, subsidiaries of U.S. companies that are audited by the U.S. firm, the U.S. lead partner has, or the lead partner on any engagement, I'm just using the U.S. firm as an example, has authority to oversee and to determine the that the qualifications of the people that are working on subsidiary audits are up to standard. So from that perspective, although that's not an directly an evaluation and a pay consideration, one would think that would have some indirect influence at least.
Yes, with regard to your question about mean and variance and the change in the IFRS numbers, as I'd start out by observing, that's more of a question of financial analysis versus auditing, and there might be others in the room that have done more work and would be more qualified to respond to that. I know there's some academic studies that I've seen and others have made some observations in those communities. From our perspective, I'm not aware that we've calculated the mean and variance on our clients. At least I haven't. There may be somebody else within the organization has. We have done some analysis with regard to differences and more from a perspective of trying to make sure we've identified them all, which included some quantified differences. And I will tell you that every industry is a little bit different, and to the extent that there are any trends that are outliers, it's there is a fair bit of variance. So it's been a couple of years since we've done that, so
Greg Jonas.
I was going to address myself to the discussion question, but if others had questions for the panel members, I'd be happy to yield the floor. Okay. I take from this discussion question that this is an aspirational question, meaning what would be ideal for a system of quality unconstrained by what is today? And it seems to me that what would be ideal we see every day in operation, and it's the way the firms conduct their own, for example, U.S. operations, where they work hard to minimize any barriers within the firm and work hard to develop common elements of quality control across the U.S. firm. And so I would think what would be ideal is to simply apply that same concept globally. And so we may have an underlying complex legal structure, but in terms of operations, control, it's a single global system uniformly applied around the world. I think in this regard, corporations, major corporations, global companies, are way ahead of the profession, where many companies have very complex underlying legal structures, but they have very tight, consistent policies and control around the world. And what I mean by common policies is a broad range of things: expert partner reviewers, training and credentialing, methodologies, policies governing conduct and protocols, standards groups, experts that people can consult with, internal inspection programs, incentive systems, management and control, including compensation and knowledge bases, would all be global. Why not?
John Morrissey.
Yeah, I actually want to get back to a point that Guy started to address, and I was really curious if the other panel members could touch on it as well. Because, you know, you talk about 120 countries, 96 countries, global organizations, clearly adds levels of complexity to any sort of management structure you might have. I can understand that. But, you know, as you touched on, Joseph, not every firm can, or every office can have the same level of quality. Okay, if you understand that as sort of a given, the question I would have then is, what do you do specifically when you have events of noncompliance with policies and procedures within the organization, and what actions are specifically taken in the past in order to ensure that the appropriate levels of either remediation have been affected or discipline has been meted out?
I'll see if I can pick up on that. I think it's what we tend to do is, first of all, look at the facts and circumstances in each case, because they do tend to differ tremendously. I think probably a starting point when you've got a performance gap is to ensure that there's an appropriate understanding of the standard to which the firm is being expected to comply. If you don't have a proper understanding, then it's hard to move beyond that. But assuming that there's a proper understanding, there's an expectation we have that management of that firm develop an action plan to respond to the performance gaps that have been identified and commit to that plan. That plan could include anything from shortcomings in documentation of their own policies and their own internal inspections. It could be issues with respect to performance of specific engagements. And so the remedial actions and the action plan will be dependent upon the nature of the particular shortcomings, but we'll expect, and those action plans typically will expect a pretty short time frame on them to ensure that action's taken promptly, and we'll follow up to determine whether or not those action plans have been implemented. Depends upon the time of year that the action plan takes place and the specific firm concerned, but at a minimum there's a follow-up visit to look at to see whether the specific actions were in fact executed, and then there'll be the specifics that were found as a result of that previous performance gap will then be the focus, of course, as part of the next inspection. If we have situations that arise where the action plan is not put into effect to our satisfaction, then we look to escalate that to more serious measures. So we have an ongoing process globally that reviews the status of performance of all of the firms in the network based upon their latest inspections and the status of action plans that they have committed to. And where we have firms that have failed to implement those action plans or are consistently failing to come up to the standards, then we'll have a series of remedial actions that we'll execute at the national board level, which in the extreme can result in expulsion. There are letters which would go, for example, from the chief executive to the managing partner of that firm, indicating that the performance of that firm is unsatisfactory, that they have not followed up on the action plan that they've committed to, And here are a series of consequences that will arise in the event that these things are not remedied, again, within a pretty short time frame. So there's essentially an escalation of pressure on that firm to comply. As I said, if they do not comply, there's an expulsion threat that ultimately can be executed.
Galen Hanson.
Despite the differences then between all of your organizations, which are very complex, we have these inspections, and if you can help me understand this a little bit, because Guy, both you and Paul commented on, I wouldn't call them rogue firms, but firms that are having struggles or difficulties and your reaction to them. In those situations, then, does the home office, and I'm assuming a U.S. home office of, let's say, an SEC registrant, do they accept that work, or do they send their teams abroad, to their audit teams abroad, to examine working papers? And in your case, John, you said you used the principal audit rule, or principal auditor approach. Does that mean then that you don't accept the work of your foreign affiliate, or do you accept some of it? And where does independence come into this? Is there an independence check? I assume that the larger three of the firms here represented, there's an independence tracking. In your case, is there independence checking and tracking such that the public is aware of you know, any issues, or I guess put on notice? My question.
I'll go first, I guess, on that, to Galen's question. Do we accept the work of our foreign affiliates? In and of itself, no. That's not how we operate. Keeping in mind, as I said before, the scale of our clients are probably quite different than the clients of the other panelists. So we're able to effectively work in that type of environment where we do send our U.S. audit teams to the offices of the foreign affiliates to work not only with the teams or the audit personnel of those affiliates, but also with the clients as well. Typically, the foreign private issuers that we are the engagement partner firm for are typically clients of the foreign affiliates. That's where their relationships lie, and so on and so forth. And they may have had offerings or registrations here in the U.S., and so the relationships are there, so we work together with them. But once again, we take full responsibility for the work. So, yes, we send our audit teams. As I mentioned before, we get involved from the acceptance and planning and materiality and just as if we were doing it solely in our office with entirely our own staff. As far as independence, this also goes to scalability, I guess, of the clients. Our clients are much smaller. We're in direct communication with the affiliated firms and what they're, you know, what services they're providing, and any financial or ownership relationships that may or may not have. So we certainly. I guess one other thing I'd like to point out is that we work only with our foreign affiliates that have agreed to be registered with the PCAOB. So we're not working with a firm that's not registered, doesn't have at least the baseline requirements of being PCAOB registered. So they're certainly representing that they have an understanding of the rules and the requirements. And we certainly inquire of the engagement team from the partner on down of independence issues and things that, you know, work that's being done. And that's how we approach it.
I'll make a couple of observations about the inspection process. Our inspection process is globally coordinated, similar to how Guy mentioned earlier. But it starts at the individual engagement level. And if we find a problem with an engagement, then we'll take that in consideration into next year's picks and follow-ups. Our remediation plans are at an individual engagement level, and we have a global consequence management policy, too,
that applies to the individual engagement level. I think that is very important and a very important complement to talking about, you know, firms where there may be more quality issues arise, because one of the observations I'll make from, you know, traveling around the world, et cetera, there are good people everywhere, and there are people that need a little help everywhere. Every now and again, you know, with regard to maybe a single country, it needs a little more help and influence. But for practical purposes, really to address the issues of quality in a global network, you got to start with the individual engagements and individual partners.
A couple of thoughts. With respect to, I alluded to this during my remarks, and in terms of there being numerous U.S. Firm personnel that are assigned currently in other member firms. I guess there are a couple of aspects here. One is that the lead audit partner for a U.S. registrant, depending upon the size of the company and you know the number of locations and so forth, will often regularly visit the various locations where audits are being done by other of subsidiaries or operations of other member firms by other member firms. And the purposes of that visit is, and usually he or she doesn't go alone. They usually take other members of the engagement team. Is several fold. One is to make sure they have a good understanding of the client's operations in those locations, but also to get to know and assess the audit personnel at those locations from the other member firms. And there will be times when there will be, I guess you'd call it additional processes put in place if there is a concern about a lack of knowledge or understanding or whatever it might be. And that might be having someone from the U.S. firm spend time there from the engagement team, or maybe on a broader basis it might be to have U.S. personnel to be located in that country, in that firm, for a longer period of time, as I said earlier, to help transfer knowledge and skills and so forth, you know, over a longer period of time. So, and I didn't comment before on to John's question. Oops, excuse me. But our processes in terms of escalation for action plans and failure to adhere to them are similar to what Paul discussed.
Wayne Collins.
I had a question for the panel. To what extent are the partners in each member firm, particularly the U.S. member firm, made aware of when there are quality issues uncovered during an inspection or otherwise of another member firm? I mean, it's one thing for some point person, let's say at the U.S. member firm, to become aware of this, but to what extent is this information permeating the firm itself in terms of the individual partners?
In our case, in the DTT case, if there's a significant negative finding in the audit work on a subsidiary of a U.S. registrant, the lead engagement partner in the U.S. is notified of that situation. And then we in our national office are notified of all of the situations within an inspection cycle in which that occurred.
As part of our acceptance and continuous procedures, we always inquire of the affiliated firm that we're working with the results of their internal inspections, Also, the results of their PCAOB inspections, they're all registered firms as well. We also inquire of their other regulatory body inspections. So, as part of our acceptance and continuance procedures, we inquire and look to the results of any deficiencies that may be noted.
At Grant Thornton, it's similar to Deloitte, not quite the same. The current policy is that the results of the inspections are made available. So there'd be a point person in the U.S. firm, to be specific to the U.S., for example, who would make inquiries of the global organization on the results of the inspections for those firms where there was reliance being placed for U.S. audits. And there'd be a letter would be provided for each of those firms. However, there are not specifics provided with regard to identifying specific client engagements. There are specifics provided if there are significant concerns, either about controls or performance issues at the firm concerns. So the expectation is that there's a communication then that would take place between representatives of the U.S. firm and the firm concerned.
In the case of the domestic registrant that you referred to, if there was a problem with quality around the world, as my understanding, the domestic registrant partner would be notified.
I apologize to all, but I'm confused, and I would appreciate help from any of you. So let me start off with my famous fictitious firm of Dewey, Cheatham & Howe. And let's make it a U.S. Firm that's registered. And let's also have another firm that's in a different country that we'll call Howe Indeed. Initially, let's assume that these firms are not in a network, but that Howe Indeed performs an audit for a company, and it is registered with PCAOB, and so it gets no reliance on any U.S. firm and does its audit. Conversely, let's take Dewey, Cheatham & Howe. It has a multinational client, and in some fashion contracts with Howe Indeed for services to be performed in its audit. In those situations, it seems relatively clear to me that we know currently how to handle any quality control issues with respect to those two audits. What I don't understand is two points. If we now create those two firms as a network, do we have some different expectation with respect to quality controls that would exceed the quality controls that we would have expected if they were not networked? And two, do investors perceive that there would be a difference in the quality of the audit somehow if Howe Indeed could use the name of Dewey, Cheatham & Howe in its audit report? So that's the question. Any one of you are welcome to ignore me or answer as you choose.
I'd be happy to make a couple of observations that might be helpful. First of all, it's my understanding that, and maybe SEC staff, if I have this wrong, can correct me, but Howie wouldn't have to employ Dewey Cheatham in order to be a PCAOB registered firm and sign the financial statements of that FPI. Appendix K would say that you have to have a review on the engagement level by somebody that was knowledgeable of U.S. GAAP and GAS. And when you don't have a network and that provides a natural place create that type of situation, you can go to the office of the chief accountant and talk about what your capabilities are and get signature. Along those lines, your question of, well, if suddenly Howie becomes part of Dewey Cheatham,
Is there a different expectation, et cetera? You know, a lot of things are based on perspective in life, but certainly once you have a global network that is aiding in a filing review program, I think that's a different perspective than somebody that is a foreign-based accounting firm signing off on U.S. GAAP who doesn't have anybody, doesn't have a network affiliate in the U.S.
Jack, if I can just follow up, what you're saying is you would expect that U.S. firm to be held to a higher level because of its foreign affiliate, even though the foreign affiliate is conducting the audit.
I did not intend to make that impression that the U.S. firm would be held to a higher level. I think there is, when you're talking about the network in totality, that, you know, I think there's probably a perception of a higher level.
Would any of the other panelists like to comment?
I'll just make an observation. I'd have to leave it to the investor representatives in terms of the perception part of the question, but and this is maybe is grounded too much in what might be common sense, but maybe you'll decide it's not such common sense. But if, the way I would look at it is if you had two firms that are independent of one another, but one firm was engaging the other, and actually that's generally not the way the process works. It's usually if two firms are independent of one another and one is going to rely on the other, the two firms are engaged by their respective clients, and then there are professional standards on how one firm is able to rely on the other. But in that, any way you structure that, what you have is two independent firms, presumably with different policies, procedures, et cetera, and I guess the common thread that the principal auditor would be looking to would be professional standards in terms of what to expect from the other firm. And contrast that to two firms that's in an association with one another where there is agreement not only to use a common name or the right to use a common name, but also having common policies and procedures, quality control policies, common inspection programs, backed up with remediation and discipline. My common sense would say that the association would be a superior situation versus the two independent firms. And that has nothing to do with U.S. firm or anything else. It just, as I said, is kind of a common sense thing.
Yeah, I would just make an observation from my past life and past experiences that I don't think there are too many situations where you have an unaffiliated standalone accounting firm signing a audit opinion at FPIs. I remember that question a couple of times, but Lynn's looking at me like he thinks there's more.
Gary? Hello?
Go ahead, Damon.
Yeah, guys, that one, get on the line, all right? Mike, the speaker just spoke mentioned who signed the audit opinion, and that's what I want to make sure I understand clearly. It seems like this is relevant to two different situations. One, the foreign private issuer; the other is potentially the auditing of foreign subsidiaries, affiliates of U.S. Of U.S. public companies. Am I right in drawing my own experience that generally in the U.S. that for each of your networks that in the case of the U.S. public company with the foreign affiliates that the audit opinion is signed by the U.S. firm, and that the foreign, and that the foreign, that the U.S. firm may, in certain respects, be relying on the work of network members, but the audit opinion expressed is the opinion of the U.S. firm. And then tell me, what is the situation typically with the foreign private issuer? What legal entity signs?
Jack?
Yeah, I'll go ahead. I'm familiar with those rules. A foreign private issuer would be, the audit opinion would be signed by the auditor of record, which typically would be the would be an audit firm in the same country as the group headquarters of the FBI that, in fact, has registered. So, you know, if it's a French company, it will be signed by a French firm. In contrast, a domestic registrant, the group financial statements or the consolidated financial statements would be signed typically by a U.S. firm. There are a handful of issues on the margin because, in fact, a foreign-based company can become a U.S. domestic registrant if it fails certain criteria, and then there is a protocol and analysis and guidance that one goes through to determine who is eligible to be the auditor of record for that for purposes of SEC registrants. But those are pretty few and far between.
Andrea, please need your help.
I'm not sure that I understood that if that subsidiary, I don't know if it was Dewey and Cheatham or Cheatham and Howe, if they were a significant subsidiary, I think you have a principal auditor issue, I think, first off. So I wasn't really sure if I quite understood where we were there. But assuming that they're not significant, I think we would have a problem in our model. Now, once again, I think our model differs to some extent, but or even to a great extent, but we would have difficulty accepting the work, certainly of a non-affiliated firm. I don't think that we would get beyond the acceptance procedures in our U.S. firms. So I think you'd have to evaluate that. If it was an affiliated firm, we'd certainly go through our policies and procedures to make their work our own. As many times you'll have the foreign affiliated firms will be issuing statutory accounts in their local jurisdiction. So, you know, audits have been done. They may have been done under a foreign basis of accounting, but we're able to then work with that firm to make their work our own, which means working together with them from the beginning of the audit right through the filing of the foreign private issuer's financial statements.
Excuse me, just a minute, Damon. Could you mute your phone? Just do you have another follow-up?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thank you. Any other panelists have any additional comments?
Excuse me. Under your model, you say you do not rely on the members of your network, and you perform as a principal auditor all of the required steps. I guess my question is, what's the benefits of having a global audit network then?
Well, I think when we say we don't rely, it doesn't mean that we don't work together with our foreign affiliated firms. I think you might be extending it then that we would send our own audit teams to do all the work from soup to nuts, let's say. And that's not the case. Like I said, we work together with our firms from the acceptance, planning, and right through the supervision, review, and issuance stages. So there are benefits, certainly. There are cultural differences as well. So you know, you need to get over those hurdles also. And like I said before, most of these clients are typically clients of the foreign-affiliated firm. So there are relationships and ongoing history of audits and local audits and statutory reporting that may have pre-existed our involvement.
Arnie Hanisch.
Yeah, I was curious. We try to determine that our financial people are qualified to do their job. I was curious as to what specifically you all do to try to verify or determine that the people working on U.S. registrants are actually qualified in U.S. GAAP. My personal experience is that many of them are certainly well qualified in the local statutory aspects of their accounting. That's the way they've been trained in their local universities. But do you have some sort of a training program or qualification program that you put the staff people through that are going to be working on the engagements of U.S. multinational companies to somehow ensure that they are validated, that they are qualified in U.S. GAAP, to understand when they're auditing that they can even identify an issue?
I'll take that one first. We do not currently have an accreditation program globally. We do the U.S. engagement team and the U.S. gatekeeper would look at the training and qualifications of the proposed members of the engagement team and the other member firm. If that foreign subsidiary is a significant subsidiary of the group, the U.S. engagement team would actually dispatch U.S. personnel to play a key role in the oversight of the conduct, planning and the conduct of the audit in that foreign jurisdiction. But we don't have an accreditation program at this time.
At Deloitte, we have a program process. Call it accreditation or whatever name one would want to give it, that does call for, through training and experience, personnel, and I think I mentioned this in my remarks, personnel in firms outside of the U.S. Member firm and other member firms be recognized as qualified to work on subsidiaries. Audits work for U.S. registrants. The degree to which that is required depends upon the size of the subsidiary, the nature of their operations, and so forth, in relation to the consolidated entity. But that by no means is all that's done. I've mentioned a couple times that depending on the size, the complexity of the overseas operation, the lead engagement partner and others from the U.S. engagement team would visit those locations periodically to become familiar with the engagement team members, and in certain situations we actually have U.S. people seconded to other member firms to work with engagement teams in those firms. So there are several ways that our engagement partners approach that situation.
At Ernst & Young, we have minimum standards of education and experience for key personnel, both for our two globally supported GAAPs, both U.S. GAAP and IFRS, and we have protocols on how to deal with situations where we may have somebody in a key position assigned to an engagement that, in fact, might not have as much experience as we like, and how to deal with that. We also, in our multi-location guidance, establish protocols for partners in important situations to make visits and evaluations.
Jeff Mahoney.
Last year, in connection with the SEC's proposal to eliminate the U.S. GAAP IFRS reconciliation requirement. A comment letter from one of the accounting investor groups on that proposal pointed out that one of the many benefits of the U.S. GAAP IFRS reconciliation is that at least some of the big four firms had special procedures in place with respect to the reconciliation, where they had U.S. GAAP and IFRS experts focusing on that reconciliation. And it was my understanding that those reviews, that in those internal reviews related to reconciliation, had a real positive effect in finding a lot of IFRS application problems before those financial statements were ever issued. As we all know, the SEC has gone ahead and eliminated the reconciliation requirement. So my question is, now that we've lost that review process that many viewed as very important in catching problems with IFRS implementation, have new procedures been put in place to replace what we've lost?
I'll take a stab at that one. As I mentioned in my remarks earlier, the move to IFRS without reconciliation creates a dilemma for organizations like ours, because our U.S. firms or U.S. offices don't, at this point, have the requisite skills and experiences in IFRS. Yet our foreign affiliates don't really have the requisite skills in PCAOB standards. So that's, when you're splitting those two components, it creates concerns. Not sure that our foreign affiliated firms can directly issue, even though they may be registered, but can they issue financial statements under PCAOB standards without quite a bit of guidance from our U.S. firms? And I don't think that's currently the case. And now with the move towards IFRS without reconciliation, that could create issues for firms that are or organizations that are structured like ours.
Other panelists would they like to comment?
Similar to what I mentioned in our opening remarks, in our case with regard to FPIs, somebody from our area desk would perform an IFRS expert review, which is in effect an extension of the independent review by somebody that's got more training and knowledge in IFRS, and there would be a coordination effort with our person who's performing the filing review. That's consistent with the PCAOB interim standards, so-called Appendix K.
I think my response is similar to that. The Appendix K lives on. From the auditing perspective, there continues to be that involvement. It does not have to be a U.S. member firm partner involved. It could be another member firm partner, particularly from more developed countries that are knowledgeable in U.S. GAAS and PCAOB standards. And then I think I mentioned earlier in my remarks we do have a consultation network that deals with consulting on IFRS matters without regard to whether there's something lost or not. I'm not sure about that.
As we continue our discussion, I want to also bring before the advisory group two other questions we had. What quality controls can investors and other users of audit reports reasonably expect from audit firms that use their names or otherwise indicate an affiliation with PCAOB registered firms and their global audit networks? And also, should PCAOB standards incorporate best practices or other improvements to enhance quality control over audits of multinational companies? Bob Kippers.
My comment actually goes back in time to earlier part of the discussion, but it's not unrelated to these questions. Dick's example of the two sort of I'll call them independent firms versus a networked version of those firms. And this is one of those things that's a little dangerous. I'm not sure I'm right on this. But I thought that the major networks largely were members of the former firms of the International Federation of Accountants, IFAC. And I thought it was that commitment and affiliation that caused those firms to be voluntarily complying on a global basis with ISQC-1, which was the standard we referred to this morning. If that's not right, then maybe I'm off base. But I thought that was the impetus behind ISQC-1. And let me tie it together with Joe's question earlier about compensation. The same section of ISQC-1 that talks about leadership that we talked about this morning in connection with the other question also assigns the responsibility for complying firms, which would be, I think, the whole network for DTT or the others, that your performance evaluation, compensation, and promotion be tied to the commitment to quality. And so while it wouldn't be a U.S. partner, comping the partner in another member firm, I think the point is that all the firms in their own way would have to comply with that standard. I also think that with respect to a networked firm, that because their network is a member of the forum of firms and therefore follows the standard, you would have that tendency to get what might be argued a little bit higher commitment to quality. And then, of course, the affiliation agreement itself is yet another commitment to stay to a certain standard, and that's where the cross-firm reviews come in. So I think that that's hopefully a fairly simple answer to that old question.
Lynn Turner.
First, I'd like to go back to a couple of your questions, Greg. On the third one, I think the answer is yes, but it's not best practices in terms of what the firms do. But I think it should be best practices in terms of quality control in industry. And I think it goes back to what Arnie was saying. I think I'd go and I'd look at how some of the large multinationals manage quality control and draw upon that to take a look at best practices, because I personally think you're going to find much better practices there than we have in the profession, because we've grown up with this structure whereby it's just, an affiliation of all these firms. It's not really a firm other than from a marketing perspective. And I think that has some serious shortcomings in that process. So I'd go back and take a look at industries like a pharmaceutical industry, where they have to maintain high quality controls worldwide, and take a look at what those do. There are some high quality international manufacturers. I'll also say that from a control point of view, I actually agree with what Greg said at the get-go, Jonas, that I think if you're really thinking about where you should move quality controls, it should be a central quality control point, which is, I think, what you're going to find in a major international organization, and it rolls down from that. And there's got to be a central point and central responsibility. And I think the question Greg asked, why not, is the right question, because I think that's where you got to turn around and migrate to. I do have some questions for the panelists, four of them really. The first one is, when you do your inspection process, I know how the firms have inspection and inspection of member firms, and you got some basic quality controls that everyone's supposed to live with, yada, 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 but a lot of the final decision at the end of the day still rests with that local group if they decide to thumb their nose at you just because of the legal structure. But I think people try to do the right thing. But here's my question. Who actually makes the selections of the actual audits to be inspected, say in a country like Japan or Australia or France? are the selections of the audits to be inspected actually made at a central location today in London where your headquarters are, or are they made by people in those respective affiliates in those countries? First question. Second question is, we've had problems with independence on an international basis. What's the quality of your compliance today, would you say, with U.S. independence rules on the audits of U.S. registrants coming in, both U.S. registrants with foreign operations and or foreign and private issuers? Third question is, I hear you all talk about the good quality controls and how the system is working and all, and yet recently there was a report of a group of investors, institutional investors out of France, that reported that implementation of IFRS in that country has not gone very well, and that in fact they found that there's far too frequently companies have just wrapped an IFRS cover around and called the financial statements IFRS when all they're doing is still doing the statutory audit. Why is it that institutional investors are finding that with the reports being filed in France if the quality controls are actually really working and IFRS are getting done right? Fourth and last question then is, y'all talk about it being a seamless central operation, like, if you will, and all these common controls across. Why is it from an investor's perspective then? Because that's the way I think you'd like us to perceive you as EY International or Deloitte & Touche International. Why is it then that the first time that we see litigation pop up, you come to me and say, I don't know those other guys, go talk to them, we're not an international company. Now all of a sudden it's you got to go after that international affiliate because we're all separate and distinct. My four questions. Have a way. This is an exciting topic. We needed some excitement this afternoon. So.
You want one guy to take each question?
Oh, no, I'd like all four for all four questions. Bob. Thank you, but no. Shoot away, gentlemen.
Selections and inspection in individual countries. As I mentioned in my remarks, there are two models for inspection in our inspection program. One model is for the more developed, larger firms. The inspection is done by the firm itself with oversight by DTT, Global Office. In those situations, the selections of the engagements to be inspected is made within the firm, but again with oversight and challenge by the DTT Global Office. For the other member firms, the DTT inspection group in the Global Office forms teams of inspectors from other member firms. In that case, the team leader, in conjunction with the Global Office oversight, makes the engagement selections.
You know, we're relying to some extent on regulatory bodies. Once again, with the acceptance and continuance procedures that we have, we inquire of their internal, of the affiliated firm's internal inspections, of their regulatory body inspections, and the results of those inspections as well. So, you know, that's how we move forward with working with our affiliates. Independence issues, our clients are scalable. You know, they generally work with one or two other offices around the world. They're not, so to speak, multinational, as that word might commonly be tossed around. In terms of they're not in 40 or 50 countries generally. So if they were, we probably wouldn't get past the acceptance process. With respect to questions, excuse me?
Independence rules, good compliance today then?
Yes, I think okay. So, because it's done on an individual office-by-office basis. With respect to the IFRS issue, I guess I'm to somewhat extent pleased to hear that it's not only us having difficulties with IFRS. It's other countries are having IFRS problems as well. So France, I guess, has been doing it for several years now. And the one firm issue, I think that's, it's really not for me to say, but I think that is a concern, or a question. What do investors expect? So I guess that'll play itself out over time.
With respect to the inspection process, Lynn, we make all the selections at the global level. There's no involvement from the member firm in the selection. And I think, as was commented earlier, that there's a number of factors that go into that. In particular, we have a sufficiently, relatively small number of foreign private issuers in our network, so that tends to be a key factor when looking at the selection internationally in those firms. And then if you've had issues on engagements in the past, in prior selections, they'll tend to be looked at again. The independence compliance question, we have raised the bar internally with regard to our own policies in this respect, and are in the process of deploying our tracking system globally as we speak. So, I think that raised focus on the topic, we've got a lot of firms now running around with greater awareness of things that I suspect if you'd looked at them before we'd introduced those policies, they wouldn't have had the same level of awareness. So I'm more comfortable today with that level of compliance than I would have been a couple of years ago.
Would you say your compliance is good today then?
The SEC had this voluntary self-inspection review program that was recently completed by the larger networks. In fact, I'm meeting with them next week to go through and discuss the process that we followed, but the results actually were very good. That's a subjective statement, but I think given the number of filers that we have, and the number of firms involved, particularly when you consider that for a number of those foreign member firms, they only had a handful of SEC registrants, so they lacked the institutional knowledge that you would expect a firm like the U.S. to have. I think the results were pretty good. I can't really comment on the French Institutional Investors report. I'm not familiar with that report. I mean, I do know that our network has only a very, very small number today of FPIs that are filing an IFRS. In fact, as far as I'm aware, we only have one. So it's a little bit early for me to really comment and see to what extent that's becoming an issue, at least with respect to SEC filers. Your last question is a tough one. I think the reality is, this is no surprise to you, I know you're an expert on the subject, but the issue is really one of self-survival. While there's a desire across the network and the member firms and a shared interest in wanting to have an appropriate quality control process in place and a lot of the common standards and procedures that we've been talking about for the last hour or so, there's also a recognition, and I think the litigation environment drives, frankly, a lot of the thinking today in the profession with regard to the international structures. I think it creates impediments in the profession that create a barrier, frankly, for the international networks to fully replicate what you were referring to in terms of what the corporates do. It's a challenge. There are those who would argue that if you want to present yourself as a seamless international global organization, then you ought to put in place the control mechanisms that fully reflect that and live with the consequences. But if you want a profession that's going to operate in the free market, then I think you can only expect the owners of the member firms to act in a rational way, and for the owners of those firms to create a single global firm, for example, I would argue, isn't rational in the current litigation environment.
With regard to the inspection process for the FPIs, those selections are made centrally by our global internal inspection group and with input from appropriate parties. If there are others that need to be inspected, for example, I might provide some input that I'd like to see a couple engagements inspected.
Let me ask you a question when you say FPIs, but what about, let's say, on a Coca-Cola, which has operations are around the globe and most operations are outside the United States. So part of those operations might be audited in China or might be audited in Australia. Who makes the selections of examinations of those audits outside and the actual review of the audit outside the U.S.?
With regard to the subsidiary audits of domestic registrants, first of all, there's a selection made in the U.S., which may include some subsidiaries, and then there's a globally coordinated program. So, regarding the independence rules, as I know you're aware, at least anecdotally, we've all invested a lot of time, effort, and money, and I think we've, at least our firm, we feel like we've made substantial progress with regard to independence. The IFRS question is, you know, seemingly the easiest, but maybe one of the most complicated, because there are a number of factors that impact IFRS implementation. And I think it's a huge issue for all of us sitting here at this table that are participants. And here's why. You know, by having IFRS out there and everybody adopting it as their national GAAP, I think the you know, the investing public looks at it and says, oh, it should be absolutely the same every single place in the world. But if you look at all the other various components in the system, there is not they're not all unified. For example, you know, the various markets are all regulated by country regulators around the world. And they've done an excellent job of working together with regard to promoting consistency, this and that, but, you know, it's still not a single system as well. And, you know, we face the same thing internally. I described earlier what we're trying to do to get consistent IFRS answers around the world. It's also complicated by the fact, and I didn't fully appreciate this till I did my first review of somebody that was implementing IFRS about 3 years ago, and I remember the reconciliation footnote was like more than 30 pages. It was unbelievable. I was surprised by that in the first place, that, you know, it would take that much to describe it, which I found surprising. Second of all, if you really study IFRS 1, there are a number of places where you can elect prior balances and or fair value as the starting point before you implement IFRS. And, you know, that has a short-term impact on what we're going to see in those financial statements. I'm not familiar with the French report. I would be delighted to read it. I would find it helpful and interesting.
So you don't have any idea why we're getting that type of implementation in France?
Well, I think I just described, you know, a number of factors that face IFRS. I'm not familiar with the report and can't respond specifically.
How about the last question about marketing as an entire company, but when something gets in or company, but when something gets in trouble, you don't know those guys.
Well, I look forward to talking to you offline afterwards to figure out how to run away.
Guy? There were a couple there for you.
Yeah, I didn't realize we were going to do them all at once like that. The independence, I'd echo what Jack said. We've certainly spent a lot of resources, in both in terms of time and people and dollars, to up the game since the late 90s, early 2000s, my belief is that things are significantly different than they were then, on the better side.
Good compliance today.
Lynn, I'd say good compliance, depending on you may not say that same compliance is good. So I would say good compliance, particularly given the number of entities involved and the number of ways that one can now slip up and violate independence rules, all the way from things that are fairly inconsequential to obviously some that are important. I would say overall good compliance. I'm really not in a position to talk about IFRS and what happened in France. I hadn't seen the report, and even if I did, I'm not sure I'd be able to comment on it. Litigation, I agree with Jack. After you talk with him offline, I'll. Although I will say, Paul gave he gave a rational explanation, I think, of some of the considerations that do go on. I mean, I would say, from just kind of a related comment, I would hope that the members of the group that maybe were not as familiar with the international organizations that we have in place before today do now have a feel for it's more than a marketing ploy or something, that we really have it, much the same way as independence globally. I think the international organization over the last several years, since the late 90s, early 2000s, have put a lot of time and energy and resources into making the quality control processes better. Otherwise, we wouldn't try to have common policies. We wouldn't spend the money on, common inspection programs and common technology and et cetera, et cetera. If there's a problem with the U.S. registrant from a litigation standpoint, you have the U.S. firm standing behind the report that it issued and is held responsible, for a problem in a small member firm speaking as a U.S. partner now, that the U.S. firm had nothing to do with, and didn't touch, wasn't consulted, nothing involved. I think Paul's observations about rationality make a lot of sense.
Let me just interrupt for a moment. Just a note that we didn't receive any recommendations for emerging issues at this meeting, so we do have a little extra time, so I think we can continue with this subject, even though the time is up, with the people who have indicated that they'd like to comment or ask questions. Go ahead.
Liz Fender.
Thank you. Jack started to address a topic of concern that I had after reading these papers. The questions I have are about the SEC did this review of filings and made a distinction between jurisdictional IFRS and IFRS as published by the IFRS. And I guess my question for panelists, it's related to the inconsistent application of IFRS as well, but the first question might be, is that information publicly clear to investors that you've made an opinion on jurisdictional IFRS versus IFRS? It seems like the SEC was able to figure that out, but I'm not sure where I would find that information, or if it's just a blank, or it's just part of a standard audit opinion on IFRS without any description.
You guys want me to take this? Having a good time.
Now, with regard to whether or not one follows IFRS as issued by the ISB, or IFRS is endorsed by another country, the SEC did make a distinction and said that, in fact, in order to avail yourself of the accommodation not to reconcile to U.S. GAAP, that you had to clearly state, unexplicitly and unreservedly, that it is IFRS as issued by the ISB, and so you should look to the basis of presentation footnote, which is generally going to be the in the first footnote of the financial statements. And in addition to that, the auditors are required to opine on IFRS as issued by the ISB, so you can look to the auditor's financial statement opinion with regard to this issue. I think there's a handful of people that have filed at this point, and to the best of my knowledge, they've all stated that. There is an accommodation that, to the best of my knowledge, impacts about six people that you can do IFRS as endorsed by the EU, if the only difference is with regard to the special temporary carve-out provision, that's a temporary accommodation, and you're required to reconcile the current year to IFRS as issued by the ISB to illustrate the difference.
Could I just follow up for a second? So that means in the future it will be clear. It hasn't been clear in the past, but it must be now that the new reconciliation requirements are in place?
Well, I'm not sure that I would choose the same words that you just chose to say that it wasn't clear. And after we get all done laughing, I'll try to provide a plausible explanation for this. The SEC rules allow for IFRS as issued by or as endorsed by the EU to be a comprehensive basis of accounting that one could reconcile to U.S. GAAP in the past. And because of the fact that most European companies, and that's where most of the IFRS implementation has occurred at this point, they are locally required to follow IFRS as endorsed by the EU and make this statement that they do that, that's why they chose that boundary gap. Now, in order to avail themselves of a prior accommodation, there couldn't be any reconciling difference where they had to do some sort of reconciliation process to only do 2 years the first year. So pardon me if I'm getting a little technical, but you're asking me technical questions.
Barbara Roper.
I'd like to actually go back to the first question that you all posted, because the more I looked at it, the more it struck me that the SEC has, in its wisdom, dumped a huge mess in your lap. In a system where we're using IFRS, which by its nature allows considerable variability of application, and which, as the study Lynn referred to, the French Institutional Investor study found, one of their findings was that there is still considerable local variability in IFRS, something they refer to, for example, as nostalgia for the old standards, in which we have very different regulatory standards in countries and structures in countries across the globe, and in which we have very different compliance cultures around the globe. And in that environment, the SEC, in its wisdom, removed the requirement that these foreign issuers listing here reconcile to GAAP, the one single factor which seemed to provide some kind of discipline in the system, not to mention the best incentive we have for further convergence between U.S. GAAP and IFRS. And now you're asking the question, is there something we can do through quality controls that gets this genie back in the bottle and that creates some kind of incentive for uniformity? And, you know, I don't know. I sure hope so. But I have to say I look at that with some skepticism, and if the SEC goes ahead with its plans on mutual recognition, I think that question gets even bigger and the lack of uniformity gets even more serious. And I just think it's a very disturbing direction that they're headed, and I sympathize with you as you look to see whether there's a route out of this mess.
I'd like to go back to a few of Lynn's comments before he asked his four questions, and in case he left this group with the wrong impression, I'd like to correct it for him. Paint a slightly different picture. Lynn, when you describe what a global network looked like today and just kind of loose affiliation of firms and some other things I won't go into, I guess I would speak for only one firm, but I don't think that's the way we look today. I think we've made great efforts to strengthen our global center. We're not to the point where we are a U.S. parent with 140 100% owned subs, so we still can't quite get maybe to the way an MNC is organized. But I guess I would just leave this group with, we've come a long way in trying to make that global center much more effective. We're further along the curve, I think, than those comments really give us credit for, and we still have to work it out for us, but we are committed to doing that, and I hope that the comments of this panel come across that same point.
This is Damon. Can I get in at some point?
Yes, Damon, go ahead.
I think that this discussion does show that certainly the firms that are present here today are you know, working on building their global networks and dealing with some of the complex issues presented by, you know, economic globalization. However, I think that somewhere in this mix is, you know, what should the PCAOB, how should this affect the PCAOB's carrying out of its mission? And the only comment I would make about that is this, that, you know, the fundamental purpose of the PCAOB is to be an outside regulator of the firms that audit public companies that are listed in the U.S. markets, and that means, you know, some level of oversight over foreign firms that play roles in that process, whether they sign the financial statements, I mean, whether they sign the audit letter in the case of foreign private issuers, or whether they are contributing in some fashion to what is ultimately a work product signed off on by the U.S. firm. And that the PCAOB, I think, needs to be mindful here not to let self-regulation, you know, sort of in by the back door. That's not the mandate. And while you all have lots of ability to tap both the strengths of these developing networks and the internal standards that they're trying to develop, and obviously to work with your foreign counterpart agencies, at the end of the day, at least insofar as companies that are listed on U.S. markets, the buck stops with you, the PCAOB.
Thank you, Damon. Mark Olson?
I've been listening to this from a couple of perspectives, and I think Damon gives me an opportunity to just reflect on a few thoughts. And your starting point, Damon, is exactly right, in that the mandate that we have is to look at the manner in which audits are conducted of companies that are listed on U.S. firms through the prism of the auditing firm. And that gives us an ability, I think, to establish a standard and hold firms to that standard. And the extent to which we rely on our counterparts around the world will, to a great extent, depend on the extent to which we're comfortable with their level of capability. But the reason we are in that circumstance is because the U.S. is a very attractive market, and markets are global, and we expect that firms outside the U.S. will be attracted to the U.S. and the U.S. capital markets. I suspect that the growth pattern of most accounting firms is exactly the reverse of that. That the reason they're global is because their firm, because their customer base is global. And so if you start from the fact that the customer base is global, then you ask the question in a slightly different way. Do you enhance consumer protection by somehow balkanizing the profession or the regulatory structure of the profession or the environment that you function in, or do you look for ways that you can, in the most practical and efficient and effective way, harmonize those efforts? And there's an extent to which they are there in conflict. Because the more complexity you add to it, the greater the difficulty is for all of us. And I think ours is probably, Damon, the easiest, because of the fact that we have a very specific mandate, and we can ask people to meet that mandate in a way that meets our specifications. But I think we need to do that in the context of being aware of all of the other global implications of the economy. You don't design an economy to fit the regulatory structure. You design the regulatory structure to fit the economy. And at least that's my take on it. So we're very conscious of what you just outlined, and to me this is a very important subject, and I know it won't end with the discussion that we have here.
Cynthia Richardson.
I just have two quick comments. Actually, one's kind of a question. I'd like to just go back to the comments the panel was alluding to about litigation and this litigation environment we're in, and I think I heard, and if I'm wrong, correct me, but that you can't truly have the quality controls of a multinational corporation like a Coca-Cola or some such organization due to this litigation environment, and you'd need some kind of liability protections. Well, the last time I checked, I mean, if I'm wrong, correct me, but the multinational companies don't have liability caps, and they seem to be doing just fine. So I'm a little confused. And about this reference to the litigation environment, the last time I looked at any of the research done by Stanford, Cornerstone Research, et cetera, but for the subprime uptick in fraud and litigation, the numbers have been declining significantly. And I think last time I looked at audit firm lawsuits, specifically class actions, I think there were five or fewer filed. So I'm always concerned about how these things are being characterized. My other comment is, if we're going to look at quality control standards, I think that to the extent, and again, if I'm wrong, correct me, but I understand that the large firms are signing the audit reports, for example, KPMG US or KPMG International. And at least when it says KPMG US, you know that some audit firm in the United States of America did the work on the audit. But when it's signed KPMG International, you have no idea if it's a China affiliate, a Brazil affiliate, whomever. So I guess for transparency purposes, if for no other reason, that if there's a quality control standard adopted by PCAOB, there ought to be more specificity in, quote, the signing of the audit report by the firm that actually did the work. Thank you.
Sam Renzel.
I don't think I was the next in line, but I think I was the next one picked on. If there is an auditor's report signed KPMG International, I would like to see it, because that organization has no employees. So if you're referring to KPMG International as something other than KPMG LLP US, then I understand your question.
So how do you sign, what are the signature blocks that you use on audit reports, U.S. versus non-U.S.? Because there's more people than me that have heard what I just said.
So we'd like the facts. KPMG LLP, that's the legal name of the organization. Now, there's 130 organizations outside the U.S. They would sign those by their legal name. It could be just KPMG, and then it would have an address as to where it came from.
Those reports also indicate the location where the report was signed.
as well.
Right.
There's specific SEC requirements that state that you use the legal name as well as the location of the office in which the report was signed.
Thank you.
Lynn Turner.
Mark, I know you guys have been doing joint inspections with the some of the foreign regulators, and I think that has worked pretty good, and I just encourage you to keep those up. I think gives you the best of someone in home country and from the registrant's country, and I think having that knowledge base is something that you ought to seriously look at, consider, continue to do. I see no reason to move away, quite frankly, today from that joint inspection type program, and it keeps both teams sharp and on their toes, and when we have things like 404 here that they may not have over there, it makes it very difficult to have inspections that are meaningful over there if you don't have members of the team from here. So I agree with you on that. Randy, I'd like to think that you are one seamless firm, and I think certainly from some of my experience that has been true, but yet when I come back and I see what's in the French report, or I see IOSCO coming out here in the last couple of weeks, and IOSCO actually writing something saying you got to start putting this in your reports. That is, you got to start putting in your reports that you're not using ISB by ISB. They don't put, IOSCO doesn't come out with something like that if it's already occurring. So they clearly saw a significant shortfall in the auditing reports by the firms. And it would be a lot better if the firms took care of that problem than IOSCO having to come out. I mean, that shouldn't have ever happened. It's just one more thing that says, until a regulator is there telling you got to do it, it ain't going to happen. Everyone knew that was the right answer. And when you see that and you hear about the joint quality control, you see what happened in Japan with one firm, I think it really does get back to what Jonas started off with, and that is, I think it needs to be seamless, one centrally coordinated outfit that controls the whole quality control process, bar none, and eliminate some of these things that cause investors, not only here, but places like France, one of the largest economies in Europe, to turn around and question whether or not you can rely upon those reports or whether or not you're getting all the facts. So I think the sooner we get to that type of situation, then with strong joint cooperation amongst all the inspectors, I think that is good. Until we get there, though, I think it's important that we keep Appendix K. Appendix K was put in because we had registrants coming into this country, and there wasn't a check. We had auditors from outside this country that didn't know U.S. auditing standards, and we've heard a little of that already today. We've seen that people haven't been able to get IFRS right in a country that should have been able to get it right the very first time, France. We've got the investors telling us we still get a nostalgia gap, and until we get those things corrected, the only way we're going to make sure that investors in the U.S. are protected is if we got someone in the national offices of each of the firms doing those reviews to make sure that they're okay. When we didn't have that before, we had some absolutely atrocious financial statements going through the filings here, and that cost the SEC a lot of time and exposed investors to risk. So I think until these things get ironed out and put in place, I think Appendix K is absolutely needed.
Greg, if I can just make one comment from a panel perspective or from my own perspective with regard to Lynn's comments. I don't know why IOSCO put out this statement. IFRS is issued by the ISB. But with regard to whether or not one was required to use IFRS is issued by ISB or a jurisdictional version, that prior to this recent accommodation, there wasn't any reason to compel people to use IFRS is issued by the ISB. In fact, they were more compelled, say, a European country to use IFRS as endorsed by the EU. So that way they could satisfy on a simultaneous basis both regulatory requirements. I do recall the fact that, you know, if you look at the international outline, you're to be explicit with regard to your basis of presentation, and that this was an issue covered at the SEC conference a couple of years ago when IFRS was initially implemented and the staff initially went through and looked at the implementation. So just food for thought.
Giovanna Pomeroz.
Thank you. I just wanted to correct an inaccurate perception that Cynthia Richardson just expressed, and it's one to do with the frequency of litigation involving auditor defendants, in particular the frequency of securities class action litigation. I think the statistic that you just quoted came from the Stanford Securities Class Action Clearinghouse and Cornerstone database. And a few weeks ago in testimony for the Treasury Advisory Committee, an open meeting in Los Angeles, Joe Grunfest apologized for contributing to these inaccurate perceptions. He said their database does not track auditor litigation accurately. The only thing it has is the count when the auditor is named in the initial complaint that's filed. And typically auditors are attached later, and so they don't continue to track that. So he actually said that they may have some kind of, they're considering putting some kind of disclaimer or making it known that that is not an accurate way to come up with a frequency of litigation involving auditor defendants on securities class actions. It understates it. Thank you for that.
Can I get in here a moment?
Yes, David, go ahead.
This is one of the most frustrating things about, I think, policy work in the area of auditing right now, is the lack of reliable data on the litigation environment. I think Giovanna certainly accurately characterized what Joe said at that hearing. On the other hand, the data that was presented by the audit firms at that hearing conflated lawsuits filed, class action lawsuits filed in the federal security system, with lawsuits filed by clients against audit firms. Not class actions, but suits filed by issuers. And then in addition to that, suits filed in the various state systems and various other kinds of duty claims. I don't think anybody really knows right now what the truth is. I do know what the totality of litigation brought against audit firms is, at least according to the industry in their submission to the hearing Savannah was referring to. It's significant, but again, you can't figure out what the real sources of it are. And it's hard to imagine a world in which we would be telling companies that they couldn't, they would have no cause of action against their auditor. But in any case, I just think that the data problems here are not limited to the problem Joe pointed out, but just to the unwillingness, I think, frankly, of either plaintiffs' lawyers or audit firms to be candid about what, in fact, is actually going on. I don't really know.
Okay, we have three more tent cards up, so we'll start in the order in the back and move forward. We'll start with Joe Carcel, and then we'll wrap up with two more after that.
I'll make it quick, Greg. Lynn and Damon and Mark Olson all refer to, in some sense, without mentioning it by name, Rule 4012, proposed Rule 4012. And frankly, I was a bit surprised that that wasn't on the agenda today. I think that's a major issue. And for what it's worth, I would suggest to the board that it's something we may want to talk about in June. You'll have the comments by then. And unless there's a final rule issued, it might be worth talking about in June. The second issue is, given the movement toward adoption of international accounting standards, it's hard to imagine that there won't be a discussion of a movement toward international auditing standards. and the role of the IAASB vis-a-vis the role of the PCAOB. I think that's a major issue that should be discussed by this group.
Lynn Turner.
I'd just like to echo what Joe just said about the mutual recognition proposal. I think it's a very good topic for this group to chew into, and I think it would be a very good one to have at the next go-around. With respect to Joe Grunfest's testimony out in L.A., Zobana is right. Joe did mention that he just picks up the initial filings and not subsequent filings. But Zobana and others have testified to us at the Treasury as well, though, that the cases against the auditors have dropped dramatically off, notwithstanding what's in the Stanford case.
Bob Kippers?
Just a couple things. With respect to Cindy's point about the corporate community not needing or having liability caps or anything of the sort, obviously huge difference between corporates that can use shareholders' money to settle litigation and the 15 of us around the table or so who have not only their capital at risk but their retirement and everything that goes with it in terms of personal assets. It's a very different model, obviously. On Damon's point, I don't know, but hundreds of millions of dollars later, it feels to me like suits against the firm by clients are just as expensive as the ones that come from other people, so I don't know why that's not germane. I think that if we have the same conversation 6 months from now, we'll find that any tail off in litigation was short-lived.
Thank you, Bob, and I want to thank our panelists for staying the afternoon with us. Thank you very much.
I, too, want to thank the panelists and the SAG, and I'm not even going to attempt to summarize this meeting. We covered a lot of ground. I think everybody can travel home feeling very comforted that you've put in a full day's work. Thank you very much. Travel safely. Our next meeting is scheduled for June 25 and 26. Here in Washington. As we get closer to that date, we will confirm whether it will be 2 days and what the specific timing will be. Thank you again, and the meeting is adjourned.